to be able to ask you to review the process that we have been doing that. If you feel a bit more at ease, it's a bit more calm now, and then you try to do that. Ask yourself, why does it begin? How does this process work? And as you understand the process, then it's time to take charge of the meditation. I remember the first time I came across this idea of dependent origination, I saw the sequence of 12 events. Yeah, dependent origination is 12 kinds of factors, and each one linked to the next one through the sequence of causality, and each link kind of calls to the next one in this 12 series of links. And the first time I saw it, I thought, it's completely incomprehensible. Yeah, there's 12 factors, one after the other, and it seemed to make absolutely no sense whatsoever. Maybe not how it goes. It starts off at the beginning with ignorance, some aspect of ignorance. I think the better translation would be delusion myself. So it says start off with delusion. Delusion causes intentional activities. Yes, so from delusion you get intentional activities. From intentional activities you get consciousness. That makes sense. Yeah? You understand the word, it doesn't make sense. Can you kind of grasp what is going on here? And from consciousness you then get name and form, and the Buddha has translated into our language, so from name and form we get the six senses. Yeah, this is how the kind of origination goes. It goes like that for 12 things. The first part is the most cryptic part, that's why I said the first part. First of all, you really don't lose them, you can start off with, yeah? You really make the part there. That is how it starts off, and when you read that, you think, wow, this makes absolutely no sense. What is this supposed to mean then? And the idea here that dependent arising or dependent origination is a teaching that is actually very profound in so many different ways. And there's so many aspects of the Dharma that actually are included in dependent origination. And that's why it is very brilliant, it is straightforward, very kind of, simple. Looks very simple, but actually it is a very profound teaching. And when you look at the suttas, the suttas, by the way, is the word of the Buddha, yeah? Sutta means like thread in Pali, it's like a red thread, if you like, it's one kind of teaching by the Buddha, essentially, each sutta. And one of the things the Buddha said in the suttas is that if you really understand dependent origination, you become enlightened, you become a stream enter. A stream enter means that you have achieved the first stage of awakening, yeah? So if you don't get awakened, you neither can ask your money back on the Sunday. It's an idea, yeah? No, but if you do get it, then you have to give it a bit of nice stuff. So it is very profound. And of course, the reality is that in the past, majority of people that hear about dependent origination, they don't get enlightened there. So the idea here is just to approximate, to get some idea what it's all about, to kind of move in the direction to understand what this is all about. Yeah, so you have these 12 links, one fact leading to the next one. starting off with delusion, going through 12-time prison, and ending at the other end, ending with suffering. Yeah, so this is 12 ends, and they are bounded on the one side by delusion, and the other side by suffering. And because it is a sequence of causality, one factor must lead to the next one. Yeah, it means basically that delusion is the root cause of suffering. This is what this means. Isn't that interesting? It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because obviously the reason why people come to the Buddhist teaching is precisely because they realize that life is often problematic, that there is suffering in life, the problems, and this then tells us what the root cause of that suffering is. Yeah, so it's actually quite interesting. It's actually very useful there. So these 12 things, what they show us, that they show us how, starting with delusion at the very beginning, how that transforms from delusion all the way into suffering on the other end. And it's actually a very interesting sequence. I won't be able to go through all the 12 things tonight, unless you're willing to stay very long. And you want to stay until midnight, okay? Actually, we can maybe do that. But actually, usually what I do is when I give a retreat, I go to the Penang Retreat in great detail. Yeah? So it goes over like 9 days or something. Yeah? That is when you really get the full details of it. So we're going to have to do it quite fast. That's okay. Yeah? Because sometimes we need to overview, sometimes we need to go. So the general idea is here that delusion somehow transforms into suffering. Why is that the case? How can we understand that? And actually, when you think about it, it's actually very obvious why that must be the case. If you are deluded about the way things work, yeah, what does that mean in practice? What in practice it means, like, you are in a new place, yeah, you don't know where the toilet is, you can't find the toilet. What is that? It's suffering, yeah? You can't find the toilet. That's one of the most desperate things in life. You have to go if you can't find it. That kind of delusion, for the directions of the path to the toilet. It's a bit like the Eightfold Path, the path to the toilet, the Eightfold Path. It's kind of a sensory similarity. Don't understand the path, so you can't get there. So it's very obvious when you think about it that delusion, if you are confused about reality, if you're confused about how to get to point from point A to point B, you're going to suffer as a consequence. Yeah? So the idea that delusion somehow must lead to suffering actually is very intuitive. It's very easy to understand why that must be the case. So for this reason, the whole purpose of the Buddhist path was really to eliminate that delusion at the beginning. And by doing so, you eliminate each of these stages going through all the 12 links until you eliminate suffering itself. That sounds good, huh? I think it sounds really cool. And in one way, it is actually that. In one way, also, it actually underestimates what actually is happening on the path. Because when we say that suffering disappears, it can often sound a bit bland as well. Yeah, suffering disappears, so what? But of course, the reality is that with the elimination of suffering, the opposite side of this coin, there's always an opposite side of every coin, the opposite side of the path, of the hand, yeah, the opposite side of the coin is that you also find the highest. That is what it means to remove suffering, to also find the highest happiness. So not some kind of bland, non-suffering state, but actually it is the highest happiness experience of all by the human being or any other human being for that matter. Yeah, so if you are not a Buddhist, yeah, you write your initial design, but it sounds good or what? Sounds good, right? But this is what the next all the session has, so now you kind of get the idea of what you're talking about. So that is the two end points of this dependent delusion on the one end and suffering on the other one. So what do we mean by, let's start off with suffering. What does this actually, how can we look at this in a way that is very useful? And one of the interesting things is the sutta, when the Buddha talks about suffering. When the Buddha starts out on his quest, the history of the Buddha, his life story. But the life story of the Buddha, most people think they know it, but actually they don't. Because for the majority of people, the life story of the Buddha is what kind of is taught in traditional Buddhism, the kind of story that has been told over centuries after the Buddha passed away. If you want to know the real life story of the Buddha, you have to go back to the earliest sutras, the sutras where the Buddha actually talks about his own life. Yeah, that's where you really find out about what the Buddha's life was about. And what he says there is actually very revolutionary and very interesting. We're used to thinking about the Buddha being a Bodhisattva. He made a vow under some previous Buddha, Sumedha, He was related with the Ankara, you know, 40,000 years ago, whatever to be able to satisfy and practice the path and become the Buddha. That is kind of traditional story there. But is that what actually happened then? Well, if you read the earliest sutras of the Buddha, what the Buddha himself says in there, when he talks about his own life, it's like his autobiography, if you like it. What he says is that he saw one problem in life, or rather a kind of a conglomeration of problems. And this problem was illness, old age, and death. Yeah? This was the problem that he saw. And he started out to find this in the Pali Canon in the early sutras. And the Buddha says, well, this is a problem in life. I have no idea. This is what I'm facing with. And then I go out into the world. Yeah, and I seek other things that are subject to exactly the same thing. I already have a problem for myself, for goodness sake. Now I seek other things that have exactly the same problem. I'm multiplying the problem that is already there. Wait a minute. Is this wiser? Maybe I should do something else. Yeah, you seek for the Buddha, this is not the Buddha and the Buddha to be. Yeah, you seek for life, you seek for all these possessions in life, maybe for children down the track and all these kinds of things. But of course, human beings are also subject to all their illness and death. All your possessions, in a sense, are also subject to death. Why? Because you're going to have to lose them eventually. Yeah, but they're for a while, then they're gone. So I have this problem with myself. I'm going into the world seeking more. Surely, this is not very wise. So the Buddha then decided what I need to do instead of seeking for other things that have the same problem as I have. I should seek for the freedom from these things, the freedom from death, the freedom from old age, the freedom from illness. But really, the freedom from death is really what it comes down to. Because death is the thing that unifies old age and illness. Yeah? That is kind of the major thing in a person's life. Down the track somewhere, you're going to have to die. So this is what made the Buddha, not the Buddha to be, made him go forward, to decide to become a monastic, to leave the household life, and try to find a solution. It's actually so wonderful when you read these kind of ancient stories, because actually it's very potentious. Yeah, you say, yeah, I had this problem, I'm going to die, let me leave the household life, go into the forest, do some meditation, and find a solution to this. Isn't that kind of amazing? Yeah. How many people do that? Do you know anyone else who does that? Yeah. Nobody does that. Yeah, I have this problem. I'm going to go to the forest and find a solution to this. It's very powerful. Very, I think, a testament to the Buddha's incredible wisdom. Actually, not only wisdom, but perseverance, energy, and all these kind of things. And he was willing and able to give up his ordinary life because he saw a problem and tried to seek a solution for that in the forest. Nobody does that. Yeah, it's just unheard of. It's not unheard of. It's extremely rare that people do this. So this is what he does, and of course, as a consequence of that search, eventually he finds a solution to this. That solution then is, of course, the end of suffering. But it's very fascinating that the idea of death, that we're all going to die, was sufficient for the Buddha to go forth and to actually seek a solution to that. And that tells us that there's something very powerful about the idea of death. If we use it in the right way, think about it in the right terms, actually, it's going to have a similar effect on us. The problem is that we think we know about death, but we don't really know about it. It's a very shallow knowledge, a shallow understanding. We haven't really internalized it properly. And because of that, it doesn't have the same enlightening force for us as it has for the world to be. That is the problem. But it shows you straight away that if you actually do think about this in the right way, it actually will have a very powerful effect on you. So how do we think about that in the right way? And one way is precisely what I was just talking about now. When the Buddha understands that all the things in the world are also subject to death. Yeah, when you think about your own life, look at the vast majority of people in the world. What are they searching for? They're searching for perhaps material possessions, they're searching for social status, they're searching for career success. Yeah. And if you start looking for the things, looking at the things that people are searching for in life, you realize that all of them are found up to this very life. Yeah? All of them will stop once you die. It's all going to stop. Your social status in this world, your career status, the possessions you have, your relationships that you have, even your physical body, it's all going to have to go. Yeah? The moment you die, it's all going to have to go. So once you understand that, and you also take into account the idea of rebirth, it opens up a vista, opens up a viewpoint of way of looking at the world that's radically different. If all you do is invest your time and your resources in things that end with this life, what does it feel like when you're going to die? What does it feel like? It feels like it. What have I done with my life? Yeah, here I am. I spend all my time investing in things that end now I'm going to die. And you feel like it. You feel it's also pointless. It's also purposeless. Everything I've worked in my life now has to come to an end. I have to leave it all behind. I can't take it with me. I've invested all my time in my possessions, in my relationships, in my status. An awkward way of doing that. I've also done things that weren't so good. Yeah, but you all think at the same time. So not only have I spent time investing in things I can't take with me, at the same time I've also kind of made a bad mental state for myself, which is precisely what I take with me into the future life. This is what happens when you die. Yeah? So if you think about death in this way, and you take into account the Buddhist idea of rebirth, this is why the idea of rebirth is so fundamental in Buddhism. Because it changes your calculation of what actually matters in life, what is important. What does, you know, long-term perspective in Buddhism really is long-term. Yeah, it's like, this is your life here, and this little tiny little space of time, and it kind of goes around like that, and whoa, this is what it's like. Okay, what investment strategy has to change? Monks are investment advisors. Yeah, you were right. We advise investments. Invest in the right way. So how do we do that? What does it mean to change your investment? Does it mean that you have to become a monk or a nun straight away? You are welcome to, if you want, sure, yeah, we can really help you afterwards if you wish to do that, but it doesn't actually mean that. What it really means is that you're changing your attitude to life. It is not so much what you do in life that is important. Yeah, you can even be, it can be almost anything except having a really bad thing like, you know, being a maybe being a butcher or something like killing lots of animals, of course, is such a good idea. But you can almost do anything in life. But it is how you do it that really matters. It is the how in life that matters. Do you do things with kindness? Do you do things with compassion in your heart? Do you try to imbue your life with wisdom and understanding and peace? That is what matters. And if we do things in the right way, then it doesn't matter so much exactly. So this is what you understand when you look at the big picture. Actually, how I live my life. What qualities I imbue all my actions, all my speech, every single thought that I have. Do I imbue with kindness, or do I have ill will, do I have all this negative traits instead? That is what how it actually turns out. So this is the power of a very, very simple thing like understanding death. If you understand death correctly, yeah, you understand the problem of dying, and actually it changes your attitude, and you look at things in a brand new way. This is why it is so powerful, and this is why death is considered such a major obstacle, and why it kind of heads, it's at the head of all the sufferings in life, death is at the top, and everything else kind of fits in under that in a certain way. So that is suffering. It's very brief, we could go on about that for a long time, yeah. I'm sure we can kind of, you know, very interesting suffering, because sometimes people think that if you kind of just enumerate all the suffering is in your life, yeah, somebody said something bad to me, I've got a knee, I got a headache, I've got all the food wasn't so nice, whatever it is, that means understanding suffering, but actually it doesn't really mean that. Understanding suffering actually means reflecting on it, understanding the deep perception of why that. It means understanding death first of all, but it also means understanding suffering from the viewpoint of meditation practice in particular. That's when it starts to become very powerful. So understanding suffering is really about insight. It's an insight into reality. It's not an enumeration of phenomena that are suffering. That's part of it. That's only a tiny part of what suffering really is all about. Anyway, I'm going to leave that for another time. When am I coming in next lesson about that? Then another time? As soon as possible. Okay, that probably means 10 years or something. So, I'm not sure what it means actually. So what about the other side of the story? So the other side, the root cause of this problem we call suffering, is then delusion. So what about delusion? What can we do about that? So in the one of the beautiful things about in the sutras is that one of the great things about being a monk, we have read so many sutras. Yes, I can draw the Buddha's wisdom from here and there and pull it all together. And in one of the sutras, the Buddha explains that even though delusion has not first cause, yeah, there's no first cause of illusion. If you go back in time, if you were able to see your past lives, you wouldn't find the first point when the illusion started out. And the reason for that is because delusion is a self-perpetuating force. Yeah, if you are deluded, but you initially don't know what's going on, and because you don't know what's going on, it self-perpetuates on and on and on from life to life. That is why it is kind of scary. You know what I mean? If it's self-perpetuating, then you're kind of, gee, but this is scary. Yeah, what's going to happen with me? I need to find some kind of key to unlock this whole thing. And this is, of course, what the Buddha sees in all about, is that key here to stop that self-perpetuating force within the illusion. But what the Buddha does say, and what is interesting, that even though it is the first source for the illusion, there are nutrients to the illusion. There are things that make it stronger, that make it grow, make it more powerful. And the thing that makes the illusion more powerful is not at the five hindrances in Pali Buddhism. You know about the five hindrances? You don't, yeah? No, okay. That's okay. Because these are kind of crucial elements of the Buddha teaching, the five hindrances. But these are basically the defilements of the mind, yeah? They're headed by things like ill will and desire at the very top, and these are kind of the two most important ones. So the illusion is supported by ill will and desire. So this is the good news, because practice in the Buddhist path, one of the key aspects of practice in the Buddhist path is to reduce the defilements. Yeah, this is what it's really all about. This is why we practice virtue, this is why we practice kindness, why we do meditation practice. Because all of that together, if you do it in the right way with a sense of investigation and reflection, these hindrances go down. And as the hindrances go down, you have this delusion. Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Yeah? I'm just kind of see if it's responsive.
Good, yeah.
Okay, great. It is great. So all we have to do is we reduce the delusion. Simply by removing the hindrances, the delusion goes down. All the 12 links also go down. And you have that suffering as a consequence. So this becomes what the path really is about. Reduction of those defilements, down and down and down, until we eliminate them completely. And when they are completely eliminated, of course, that is when there is no support, there's no nutriment for delusion anymore. It becomes very weak because there's no nutriment, and that's where it can be overthrown. And we can actually eliminate delusion once and for all. But this is what the other side of the path is about. This talk is not just about dependent origination, it's also about dependent liberation. That sounds even better than dependent liberation, yeah, so we can talk about that in a second. So this gives you a hint about where dependent liberation, what it is all about. It is about eliminating those hindrances, starting with ill will and desire, eliminating it completely, and then finding liberation as a consequence. But before I do that, I'll say a few more things about dependent origination, because it's such a beautiful teaching, and it's very, I think, some of the critical things actually very important to point out, so you kind of get a rough grasp of what this is actually about. So part of this sequence of the 12 links starting with the delusion and the suffering, part of this is the idea of rebirth. Yeah, so it shows us not only how delusion ends in suffering, but it shows us how delusion ends in suffering through the process of rebirth. Yeah, that is part and parcel of what this is about. So this gives you a very clear idea of, you know, what the problem is from a Buddhist point of view. The problem is really this cycle, samsara cycle of getting reborn again and again and again. And this is really ultimately what is the problem here. So rebirth is a fundamental aspect of part and parcel of dependent origination. The other thing that is very important in dependent origination is the idea that consciousness itself is conditioned. I said before, if you remember, I said that from consciousness you have nama, rupa, amaravai, name, and form. Yeah? And there is one sutta which points out that nama, rupa, name, this is a Pali term, name and form in English. Nama, name, same word, yeah? You know, all Indo-European languages, so Pali and English are very closely related to each other. I happen to be Norwegian, same thing in Norwegian, yeah? Nama. French, nom, yeah, that's all the same word. Always in the European language, the same word. So, nama, rupa, name, and form. And this sutta points out that not only is consciousness the cause and condition for name and form is the cause and condition for consciousness. These two are mutually conditioning factors. They depend on each other. And then when I use the center layer, the two sheets of straw, I have two sheets of straw leaning against each other like this. If you take one away, the other one falls. Take the other one away, the other one falls. Yes, so they depend on each other. They are not independent entities. And this is one of the most revolutionary teachings of the Buddha. One of the most fascinating things. Because at that time, in ancient India, 2,500 years ago, the predominant teaching was the Brahmanical teaching. This is the precursor to modern-day Hinduism. And of course, in modern-day Hinduism, they had this idea of the ultimate self, the Atman. Yeah, the Atman, the kind of the final essence, if you like, of a human being that unifies with Brahman when he passes away. And this is the essence of what it is to be a human being. But the Buddha comes along, he says, there is no such thing as an Atman. There is no independent self, an inherent essence, a kind of personal identity which is always there. This thing doesn't exist. Consciousness, yeah, the sense of awareness, the most basic thing that we have as human beings. Consciousness just means the ability to be aware, to know, to actually be aware of what is going on. That's what consciousness is all about. That most basic aspect, what it is to be a human being, that itself is conditioned. And this is the radical insight of the Buddha. And this is perhaps considered the most important of his teaching, because this underpins the whole teaching of anatta, of non-self, all these things. It underpins that idea, the mutual conditionality of consciousness and metaphor on the other matter. Because what this means, it means that if you somehow are able to eliminate metaphor, yeah, consciousness itself is eliminated. If you eliminate consciousness, you eliminate metaphor. Metaphor, we can roughly think of it as all the other aspects of experience. Yes, of experience is awareness, but it's also feelings, it is also perception, it is the will, and all of these kind of things as well. Yeah? So all these other aspects of experience condition consciousness, and consciousness is dependent on this for their existence. So this is the radical teaching of the Buddha. He actually teaches the path to the elimination of consciousness. Yeah, be ready for that. It's radical, yeah. But what is, and it sounds kind of scary with elimination of consciousness. Must be kidding, you know, I come to the wrong place. Okay. People think, whoa, I'm in the wrong place, because too much. So, and of course, the point is that the Buddha says, well, actually, if you want to overcome suffering, this is what you want to do. This is what you have to do. If you want to find the highest happiness, this is actually what you have to do. This is the path to get there. So if you think of it that way, of course, then actually it's quite acceptable. But this is, in any way, the most profound aspect of the Buddha's teaching. So, yeah, this idea of consciousness itself is inherently dependent on other factors. Remove the other factors, consciousness itself disappears. Yeah, if you feel that sound a bit over the top, a bit scared, don't worry too much about it. I'm just kind of throwing it out there, because it is such a fundamental part of what Buddhism is about. Just give that thing to know about this thing. So these are three of, I would say, the most important ways of thinking about dependent origination. Yeah? It's the idea of understanding that suffering ultimately is caused by illusion. It is the idea that it actually involves rebirth as an inherent part of it. And the idea that it shows the mutual conditionality of consciousness and all the other aspects of experience. Yeah, this is a kind of three very important, but it's a very rich teaching, and as you investigate it and as you understand it, you actually start to pull it apart and you start to understand some of the richness of what is going on here. But before I go on to dependent liberation, I can't see my head. Oh, I can't really see this much anymore. Doesn't matter how far over the way. Usually your arms are too short, yeah? After a while, the arms aren't even short. It's nothing to do with the arms, then it was something to do with, I don't know what. That's my concept, yeah. What? You want to read from here? Yeah? Quarter two. Good, right? Yes. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. I can't see others now, but more eyes are going to be quiet. That's great, but the other one is very boring. Yeah. I'm wrong, by the way. You know, I'm wrong. Yeah, you know, I'm wrong, okay. He's kind of the master of kind of exaggerating just a little bit sometimes, so I kind of learned that from him, so please, but it's not my fault. Conditionality, yeah. But very briefly, before I go on to the idea of dependent liberation, I want just touch on very briefly about how this process of conditionality works, especially starting from the beginning, but it sounds so cryptic, that hitters are going to intentional activities, going on consciousness, and then going on then form. What is actually going on here? And the idea, what is actually going on here, the idea of delusion, there's many ways you can look at delusion, but one of the most profitable ways of looking at delusion is to understand it in terms of the three characteristics of existence. According to the Buddha, they said that existence has three characteristics. Impermanence, or unreliability, if you like. You can't really rely on things. Things are always changing and becoming something else. And because it is impermanent, unreliable, the second characteristic is that of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. Because you can't rely on them, because you can't hold on to them, they disappear, people die, things kind of get stolen, or you lose your possessions, whatever it is. It's unsatisfactory, it's suffering. And because it is unsatisfactory, it's suffering and impermanent, it means that when you analyze yourself in the right way, when you look inside yourself, you can't actually find any permanent essence inside of you. This is the idea of non-self. These are the three characteristics of existence. And normally, we don't get this. This is what you're doing with that. Normally we think, things are kind of permanent. Well, we don't actually think that, but we kind of feel that in a deep way. We haven't really taken on board the idea of impermanence fully. But it's almost like a feeling. It can be very hard to pinpoint. And things are much more reliable than they really are. That's the first aspect. The second aspect is that we have a tendency to seek for happiness in the wrong place. We seek for happiness in the things that belong to this particular life, as I was talking about before. Enjoy yourself. There's so much life entertainment in London, right? London is a great city. All the entertainment, a wonderful place. So you enjoy all the entertainment, enjoy all the kind of the coffee bar. I don't know what's in London anymore. I've been living in a long, long time ago. So that's ages ago. That's almost like a past life, actually. It's true, past life. And this is what people think. This is what the world is about. So enjoy yourself, have a relationship, enjoy all the pleasures of the world, have a nice job, and all these kind of things. So we go out searching because we don't really understand where happiness is to be found, where true happiness actually lies. We seek for it in the wrong place. So we start off with illusion, not understanding what happiness is, and that leads to all these intentional activities. This is how I translate the word sankhara. You may have read English translations of sankhara, volitional formations. Does anyone here understand the phrase volitional formations? I don't. I was reading this for years, but I've made absolutely no sense to me volitional formations. So you have to translate it in a way that is meaningful for people. So intentional activities kind of make sense. Activities means speech, it means actions, it means thoughts, and they are intended. We actually want to do that. That's actually much more, to my mind, a very useful translation of sankhara. So when you don't know where happiness is to be found, or you think that happiness is to be found in a certain place, you start acting to get that happiness. If you think that happiness is in relationships, still enjoying yourself in the world, is kind of having a career, having kind of boosting your social status or whatever, you put effort into that, you start acting accordingly to boost this thing, it's natural. So delusion leads to all these activities, and you try to kind of get hold of these things. And if you have no concept of the importance of morality and ethics and kindness and all these kinds of things, in your search for that happiness, if somebody gets in your way, you want that relationship, somebody else is there to do some bad things, as a consequence, you get that kind of rival out of the way, because that kind of a bit of trouble. If you're interested in the person as a rival there, you do some kind of funny, dodgy things to get rid of the rival, People do this kind of stuff all the time, because obviously relationships is one of the really big things in life for most people. So what happens if all you do is search for happiness in the sensual world, you have no idea of the importance of ethics and morality, what you're going to do, you're going to start to do bad things sometimes. Sometimes you do good things, and that is right, but if necessary, you also do bad things. Why? Because you're searching for happiness. You think that's where happiness lies, so of course you're going to do bad things as a consequence. So what happens is that in life, depending on kind of your idea of what matters in life, you start to do all these intentional activities. Yeah, some bad, some good, some neutral. And if you do a bad intentional activity, if you say something nasty to somebody, you do a bad act, how do you feel about yourself afterwards? Yeah, you feel a bit bad about yourself afterwards. That's why I feel if I say something nasty, I try not to say so many nasty things. It sometimes kind of comes out, oops, too late, already. Yeah, so it's true though, afterwards you feel a bit kind of, you feel really bad, you feel terrible about that. So you do something, even sometimes you think about God. And what you may have noticed is by thinking about God, it's like you are eliminating some of the energy in your mind. Have you noticed that? Bad thinking tends to eliminate the energy and the joy in the mind. It drags you down and makes you kind of feel, lose your energy, lose your joy in mind, lose your sense, lose all these kind of problems. But on the other hand, if you do an act of kindness to somebody, yeah, you offer something, you are generous to someone, you say a kind word to somebody, you do a deep act of kindness, afterwards you feel good about yourself. Yeah. It is not the kind of ego thing, very often it's a quiet sense of happiness. You know, yeah, I've done something good. I have lived well. Yeah, you feel that inside of yourself. Yeah? So this is what we mean by intentional activities affecting your consciousness. The level of the consciousness, just like the metaphorical way of talking about it, but your level of the consciousness, you think of happiness as a high level, and kind of depression or sadness as a low level, that level of the consciousness depends on your intentional activities. So if you maximize the good activities, if you only live a life of kind of feel like a saint, yeah, and the saint is here, you're on the way to sainthood, right? You're on the right direction. That's good enough. On the way. The more sensible you are, the more good actions you do, the more happy you feel about yourself, and the more you are lifting up, the more your consciousness is soaring as a consequence. And what is happening here, this is cumulative. Yes? So the more you do of good actions, and the less you do of the bad ones that drag you down, the more your mind soars up. It becomes light, it becomes bright, it becomes joyous, it becomes energetic. All of these powerful things has come to you as a consequence of living well. Your consciousness is affected by your intentional activities. Does it make sense? Yeah? So you start off with illusion. You search for happiness in the world. You do all these intentional activities. As a consequence, your mind is affected either in a good way or in a bad way, most often in a kind of neutral way. And in this way, your consciousness then goes up and down. And depending on how you live your life, either at the end of it, live really well, the consciousness will be at a higher level when you started out. That is what I call the life well lived. Yeah? Because you enter higher up than where you started out at the beginning. Yeah? If you're kind of lower when you end your life than when you started out, that's called the life. How can I put this diplomatically? not so well lived, yeah? And someone said badly lived because of, you have done the bad things. So this is kind of the idea, and this is becomes the purpose of life, really, is to maximize that level of consciousness as much as possible. So when you die, you actually die at a higher level than when you started out. Then when you die, you become so satisfied with yourself. You know you have lived well, you know you've done all the right things, and you think, whoa, I lived really well. And you feel kind of content because of that. And it doesn't matter so much if you have to give up all your possessions. It doesn't even matter so much if you have to give up your relationships. You can deal with that to understand that these things are impermanent because you're taking with you something far more valuable into the future. A good heart, a sense of kindness, a sense of something very positive and joyous. That is the meaning of life. And the more you lift up your consciousness, the more kind of happy you're going to feel when you eventually die. And the idea here, this is where the idea of consciousness and Namarupa comes in. When you die, because you have already had lifted up your consciousness, that consciousness continues at that level when you die. And because it continues at a higher level, you get reborn accordingly. Nama Rupa, the contents of your experience, will change according to that level of consciousness. Yeah, it's almost like in the human world. You can imagine yourself being born either very poor, in a very difficult circumstance, with a sick body, and very stupid or whatever. It can be born in a very good circumstance, yeah? With having a good education, having really nice parents, all these kind of things. So even within the human realm, there's a lot of difference between human beings. So So you can imagine, say, if you lift yourself up and your existence, your experience of life changes depending on your level of consciousness. And that is what it means that nama rupa depends on consciousness. So this is how it works. And what happens in the visit sequence is that after a while, you start to understand more and more, you reduce your delusion. And as you reduce your delusion, you start, first of all, to do more good actions, less bad ones. As a consequence, you do the right kind of attention activities. You lift your consciousness up. Then you start to do meditation practice. And as you start to do that, you realize actually, all these intention activities themselves are actually a pain in the backside. Yeah? So you don't do any more intention activities at all. And you get into some incredibly profound states of meditation. And you start to understand that this actually is where real happiness is to be found. Where you do no intention activities whatsoever. And this is where you start to see the escape from samsaric existence. No delusion, no intentional activity, it means no level of consciousness anymore. If consciousness doesn't have any level, it means that there is no experience that matches with it. And consciousness stops right there. This is called the exit from samsaric existence. Yes? No? Maybe? Maybe. Say maybe. Okay. It's okay to say maybe. Yeah? Sounds kind of cool, but we don't know. So, this is the rough, actually a very good idea of what dependence originates with all of that. If you understand that basic principle that I've been kind of trying to make out now over the last 10 minutes or so, if you understand that, you understand a lot of what dependence origination is about. It goes on another 8 links afterwards, but really it's almost like a repetition of the first thing, the second and last thing, and very much a similar kind of idea that is about. So, now, dependent liberation. How does this all fit in with dependent liberation? And the idea here is to eliminate delusion at the very beginning of the path. You start to understand, one of the things that you start to understand that I was just mentioning now is that living well, living with kindness, avoiding doing bad things, hurting other people, animals, whatever. Yeah, this is very important to be able to lift up your mind to make yourself feel better. So this is where dependence liberation starts. You understand something about suffering in life. And when you understand something about suffering, the consequence of that is that you start acting and living better because you know now where to find happiness. Yeah, when you live better, if you do this in a very systematic way with perseverance and commitment, what happens? What happens is that you start, you have less remorse, yeah? Less regret about how you lived. Because you have less regret, you start to feel more joy in life. Yeah, so this idea, how we work called Kambuja, which means like gladness and joy, starts to arise. And this is where we come again into meditation practice. When you meditate, you sit back, and it's quite beautiful here. I don't know if you've done this before, when you sat back, and you feel the atmosphere in here. It's quite nice, yeah? And part of that niceness is just not just the external atmosphere, but actually the atmosphere inside of you. When that atmosphere is positive, the joy tends to come by itself. The joy comes in. And as you keep on watching the breath or doing your meditation, whatever it is, that joy becomes more powerful. And the joy eventually moves into tranquility. And tranquility becomes an even more profound source of happiness. Yeah, and I'm just quoting basically the idea of dependent liberation as it is found in the suttas. That profound sense of happiness that comes when the body and the mind are completely tranquil, that leads to what is called samadhi. And samadhi in Buddhism is a deep and profound state of meditation when the mind becomes absolutely still and unified, and there's no movement in the mind at all anymore. All craving, all desire, all volitional or intentional activities, all of that has completely stopped. You find complete peace of mind for the first time in your life. And that is one of the first really radical experiences you can have on the Buddhist path. Because what it shows you, yeah, normally in our life, it is full of activities, running after happiness all the time, trying to find happiness there, craving for this, craving for that, using our intentional activities to try to get the stuff that is important in life. And now, for the first time, you realize the thing that you were chasing after all this time, yeah, that craving was driving you on all this time. Actually, you find that by giving up the craving, by becoming completely still inside, you actually find that thing that you were searching for all along. Yeah, that is radical. It is incredibly radical because you realize the world is actually completely upside down on it. It is by not chasing after the sun that is how you find your happiness. And when you find that profound happiness and contentment inside of you, when craving is completely gone, there's not a desire, it feels like you have found the answer to the meaning of life. That's what it feels like if you have no drive anymore. You don't want to do anything anymore because you feel so utterly happy, so utterly content, so utterly blissed out. It feels like you don't want to get up from the sea ever again in your entire life. But that is exactly the idea of the meaning of life. That is what it means. So this is why this is so exciting, yeah? When you get into the meditation, you start seeing this thing, you start seeing things that you had no idea actually was possible. But that is not the end of it. And the real is not the end of it. This is only the first phase of the idea of meaning of life. You realize that even the samadhi is a conditioned state. It comes and goes according to conditioned phenomena. So you actually have to go beyond it. And so then you use that samadhi as a basis for insight. Yeah, you have in this famous sutta, which is called the Ten Liberations, said that samadhi is upanishad. Upanishad is like immediate cause or proximate cause, something like that, for Yathabhuta Namadasana. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And it's the same, the Pali word would sound a bit more impressive. As a teacher, you have to have authority, yeah? So you use the Pali word, get more authority. That's why I'm doing this kind of thing. So, Yathabhuta Namadasana. I'm not going to say it in English because then I give the word again. It means seeing things in accordance with reality. That's what it means. So, based on that samadhi, because your mind is so settled and it's so together, and because there are no departments in the mind anymore, that is the moment you have the ability to see things in accordance with reality. Yeah, and what this means, of course, when you see things in accordance with reality, I am not seeing things in accordance with reality. They are all over and they are actually out there. So when you see things in accordance with reality, what is that? It is the exact opposite of delusion. In delusion, we're not seeing things like what we are. It's almost by definition. So you can see here how this undermines the very first factor of dependent origination. Yes, seeing things like what is reality brings us back to the starting point, which is the very first factor of dependent origination. That is destroyed. Delusion is gone. You're seeing things clearly. So what happens then? Well, what happens then is that we get this opposite sequence called dependent cessation. Yeah, so when the delusion is broken, delusion has ceased, all the other factors of the dependent origination cease one by one after the other. So from the cessation of dependent of delusion, you get the cessation of intentional activity. The cessation of intentional activity is the cessation of consciousness. The cessation of consciousness is the cessation of name and form. And so it goes all the way out to the cessation of suffering itself. And this is how this whole thing ultimately comes to an end. There's a beautiful part, yeah? It is wonderful. Some of the things that I did mention about this, in which maybe you caught as I was saying this, but one of the marvelous aspects of this path of dependent liberation, is that, first of all, it leads to seeing things according to reality. Well, that's the most important thing. But what is so beautiful about it is that it is so much about happiness. So much about joy, so much about tranquility, so much about this wonderful thing that everybody wants in life. Yeah? From the idea of living a moral, upright, and a life of kindness comes joy, comes happiness. From that comes tranquility, comes more happiness, comes samadhi, where literally you start to understand the meaning of life for the first time. Isn't that astonishing? Every factor of this path, this is actually the path of meditation itself, is all about happiness. Yeah. Would you like some more of this or what? Yes, please. Would I be a kind of reason? Oh, Jesus, you know, why did I become Buddha a long time ago? I'm wasting my time. This is what everybody wants. So that is what it's about. This is what is so powerful about it. Of course, it doesn't mean every time you sit down, you're going to become blissed out and become very happy. That's what it means. What it means is that this is what this path, when the path works, this is the result that this path actually is. It's so beautiful and so powerful. And you start to experience this as you do the practice. Gradually these things build up in your life. Yeah? It's so wonderful when that happens. And if it doesn't happen, basically it's because you're not doing things quite right. And you need to ask yourself, what am I not doing quite right? Yeah, if you commit to this, if you persevere with this, eventually these things will happen as a consequence. More and more joy, more and more happiness, more and more tranquility, more and more harmony with your fellow beings. And on top of that, there's additional bonus to that. Yeah, this is what is so hard to, much harder to see, but it doesn't really matter so much, is you also destroy delusion and make the final end of suffering as a consequence as well. Yeah, win-win. Win-win-win-win-win-win-win-win-win. What does win-win mean? Really anyway. So, there you are. That is a little bit dependent on origination and dependent liberation. Really not good what it's supposed to do. So, that is probably all I want to say on this topic, at least for now. And I always like to open up for questions, for comments, or complain, but they don't complain too much. Yeah, it's not so much. If you really have to complain about it, but, you know, not too much at least. But if you'd like to ask some questions or comment on what I said, you are more than welcome to do so now. I always like to remind people that what I said, that if you ask questions, then you're going to become more intelligent in your future life. Yeah? Anyone here will be some done in the future life? Okay,
You mentioned that one should leave their life, so at the end they can be happy if they are higher. Well, it's better than where they started. Yeah. But how do you know where you started?
What you do is just you kind of feel the life, whether you have a general kind of movement upwards. Yeah, you don't know exactly where you start. I mean, obviously you can remember being a baby, you just feel whether you have a general movement of the life. One of the great things about reading the sutras for yourself, have you read the sutras? You've listened to me, okay. Well, remember, I was a pilgrim, yeah? So what you get from me, I'm just probably commentary reading. Okay? So, you know, sometimes you can read it for yourself. But anyway, one of the things that you start to see when you read the sutras for yourself, sometimes you get teachers that are really powerful for you. The Buddha has a lot of similarly, they have a lot of short, succinct teachings, and sometimes you read something and think, this is so marvelous, yeah, this is so beautiful, it's so great, and this kind of really makes sense to me, and nobody's ever told me before that. And this is the problem, whenever you listen to talks, what you get excerpts of the sutras, yeah, you get a little bit from there, a little bit from here, but you never actually get a comprehensive overview of what is there. So the only way to really find out if there are teachings of that really, you know, that really hit you home, so to speak, in a very profound way. That's what you really want to read it for yourself. And one of those people that I found was very powerful for me, that I had never heard before, as I read the teachings, was when the Buddha said, how do we make decisions in life? How do we kind of decide whether you're a monk, for example, should I stay in this monastery or that monastery? Should I have this teacher or that teacher? Yeah, I'm kind of staying with a monk for 24 years. 24 years, but not, take somewhere else, yeah. You know, with after a while you get bored finding, yeah, well, you know, I don't know, I'll say the same thing again, you know, same old story, But then I think, wait a minute, that's not the point of monastic life, yeah, it's not hear stories of the hear stories. And that is when the Buddha said, the point of everything is, are you improving wholesome standing and declining in better ones? If you are on the right track, and you should, if necessary, if you are asked to leave the monastery by the abbot, you should chain yourself to the front gate. Yeah, it's like being an activist, yeah, chain yourself to the front gate. This is how monks are activists. So, the Buddha actually said that, but this is what is so cool about it, that if you are doing what is the whole purpose of the monastic life, improving wholesome states, declining in the bad ones, you should refuse to leave, you ought to leave. They're kind of nice, because the reason is because you are fulfilling the purpose of this life. That is all we have to do. As long as you are improving the good things and you are declining in the bad ones, you are fulfilling the purpose of the spiritual life. You know you're heading in the right direction. You know one day you'll get the results of the path. Never look for specific results. Never ask yourself, oh, when am I going to get jhanas? I want jhanas. Please, this retreat, give me jhanas. Yeah, that's the wrong way of thinking about it. The right way is, am I improving or not? That is the right one, yes. Because you cannot hurry up the dharmas by wanting them. In fact, you slow them down by wanting them. So instead, you kind of take a different approach to these things. So. Yes, have I asked the question? I have no idea. Was it kind of a question anymore? I see it. Anyway.
You have Okay. Yes.
Is this not the in Hindu tradition the same as in Buddhist, like Kundalini?
It's not samadhi in that.
In Hindu tradition.
It's the same, man. It is basically the same meaning because samadhi existed in prior to the Buddha. I don't know if you have read it. You know a little bit about the mind of the Buddha. It's not known by having teachers and these other teachers that very likely were part of the Brahmanical tradition, and they taught samadhi as well. So basically it's the same thing. What the difference is the interpretation of the samadhi. Yeah? What does it actually mean? In the Hindu tradition, they tend to see samadhi as an emptiness of life. But in Buddhism, we try to actually see samadhi more as a tool, if you like, on the path. But that is really the difference, I think. Basically the same thing. And it's not just, you know,
samadhi is accessible basically for anyone, doesn't matter if you are Hindu or
there are people, you know, some of the Christians that maybe it's been heard of them, they have to take a good version of samadhi. And I think almost all of the religious traditions that have a contemplative discipleship have some degree of access to samadhi at some level anyway. And atheists who have samadhi, it's a little difficult mind, it doesn't matter how you believe you have samadhi. These are natural phenomena of the mind that will happen regardless of your religion or natural religion or whatever. So, yeah.
Yes. The teachings that I talk about how life started, you alluded to like illusion having like no cause, so it's sort of always been around. I mean, it's the elimination of suffering and you know, ends up that you're not, with you end the birth with that. Is there anything in terms of how it all
started? How it started? I mean, how did you make the universe started? Yeah, the Big Bang or something like that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've grown up as a Buddhist in Sri Lanka and never really engaged with it.
You have to read the sutras, yeah? Read the sutras, it's all there,
I would love to read it myself, but I just want to know if there is reference to it.
There is, yeah. My job is to tell people to read the sutras, that's my only job. Like, I just come here, sit down for 5 minutes, read the sutras, and I can walk out again, yeah? You did enough. But I'm going to tell you something more anyway, just because what the sutras say, and this is actually very interesting. Because one of the things the Buddha said, and he said in a number of different places, he said that first of all, you cannot find the first starting point of delusion. Yeah. He also said you cannot find the first point of rebirth. Yeah. You cannot find the first point of samsaric wandering and roaming around it. And so what the Buddha said in effect, and he said this by going back eons and eons, going back life after life, there's no first point to be discovered. This is interesting in many different ways. It is interesting because he doesn't say there is no first point. He says there is no first point to be discovered. Now this is actually a dramatic and very important distinction. Because if you say there is no first point, you're making a philosophical claim about something you never actually know. And the Buddha was not really into philosophy in terms of speculation about things. He was into the practical applications of so what he said is not discover the first point, but it's quite different from saying that there is no first point. But still we are hindered in the fact that we can't discover a first point as well. Yeah? Because what it means basically, as you come back, the Buddha claims to have remembered, you know, lots and lots of past lives, as you go back, there is never any first cause to be found. There's always something beforehand. And to me, this is a very rational way of looking at the universe. Yeah, most religions around the world, most people around the world, part of the purpose of religion is to kind of explain how the world started. Yeah, we God created the universe, how bad there is. What about God? Where does he come from? It doesn't really explain anything. It just put God in place of the universe, it doesn't explain anything. Yeah, it's kind of very sensible and very true. So the Buddha says that actually that the first point, no first point is discoverable. It just goes back and back and back. It is unsatisfactory in one way because you want explanations, but actually when you think about it, it's a far more rational way of looking at things. And to have a kind of a starting point, but suddenly everything bam, came into existence. Yeah? And even scientists say it's here. It's very, one of the things that the scientists has said is that, well, we can explain a whole universe.
There's only one thing we can't get. Like at the very first big bang, how can we do this? They give us one free miracle, and we can explain everything else. And that science couldn't say that. They give us one free miracle. That's not the right way for a scientist to think. That's basically what they have to say, because they cannot explain the first half of the point. Yet, it may come down the track, but not yet. So that's why some of these things are actually very, very powerful. And because they fit with common sense, I actually, because this is one of the things I'm actually very happy to have to be able to actually research. Okay, yes?
Failure origination, craving comes from the middle, right?
Yeah.
But in the Four Noble Truths, Buddha says craving is the cause for suffering.
Yeah.
Just wondering why delusion is not given as the cause for suffering. Dependent origination, delusion is the main cause.
Yeah. Well, they are both causes, yeah? But they are causes in slightly different ways. So the point of craving is the thing that actually ties you to the wheel of existence. Yeah? So when you crave, craving is the force that drives you on from one life to the next one. It's like it almost projects you into the future. Yeah? As long as you are craving, it's almost like you are already in the future already, because craving is always about kind of future things. So craving actually ties you to the wheel of existence. And this is why it is said to be the cause of suffering, because it actually literally ties you down. But craving itself cannot be stopped just like that. So you need to go back to understand why craving happens. And craving happens because of delusion. So delusion is something you can do something with. Craving you can do a little bit with it. You can reduce it a little bit by thinking and wiping and all these kind of things. But you cannot eliminate it as such. To eliminate it, you have to eliminate delusion. And that is why the Buddha brings it back all the way down to delusion instead. And then there's a nice sutta about it. That obviously is a sutta about everything. Yeah, it's sort of every conceivable thing. Yeah. So, in one place, the Buddha actually substitutes the 12 factors of dependent origination into the second noble truth. Yeah, so that is there. Instead of praying, you have the whole 12 in series. So there are just alternative ways of looking at the same thing. Yeah. Alternative kind of viewpoints. So one shows you what binds you, and the other one shows you what blinds you. Binding and blinding, yeah? So this is kind of equal to that. Make sense? Yeah? Okay. Great. Yes?
I was thinking of the non-self characteristic sutta, the Natarakana sutta there in the citation as well. In terms of Nibbidagra when you wrote the citation.
Yeah.
And in that it seems to start off looking at the five aggregates. And looking at the three destructors.
Yeah.
And then that leading to repulsion, discussion, cessation.
Yeah.
I wonder if that might be an alternative way of looking at how to get to states of ceasing.
Yeah, it's not really alternative. These are integrated. These things go together. So to understand the Tilakana, you know, if you want to understand it very deeply, you have to have some other precedent. You have to have the power of the mind. So basically it goes together. So when I say that, you know, samadhi is the Upanishad, is the approximate cause for Yatra Buddha Manadasana, taking that according to reality, that is actually what you're seeing there. So you see the Tilakana of the five khandas, the five khandas being the five aspects of personality, we call them, if you like. Yeah. Then from that, as you say, you get Nibbida, which is a different sense, mental nonsense. It's more like repulsion, being repelled by the world because you are repelled by suffering. You don't disheartened by suffering, you are repelled by suffering, yeah? Isn't that true? Yeah. So and then you are, because you are repelled by that, you have the viraga. The viraga is like fading away. And what is fading away, that primarily is craving itself. And in that sequence, in that particular case, cessation, the main idea of cessation there is actually cessation of craving, I think, is what it meant there. And then you have liberation, because craving ceases at that point when it's liberated from the round of existence and the consequences. So it is a slightly different angle. It really comes down to the same thing. And there's other different angles of seeing the same thing. And this is kind of the beautiful thing about the sutta. The more of the different angles you see, the more you start to see the Dhamma as a big picture. It's like this jigsaw puzzle. You have all the pieces fitting nicely together. The more you see of the picture, the more kind of clarity you have about what's going on. So, is that what you meant, Matt?
Yes, sir.
Yeah?
Sorry.
Yeah?
I think it's a big thing to liberation,
Yeah, we must be in the Buddha Madhyana. Yeah?
Sorry, I think that was on the jhana section in the Kamayam Madhya group.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, if you read the sutras, the jhanas almost always the, it's part of, it's a bit part of the path, yeah, and it's part of all these things, but yeah. Yes?
Does the sutra offer guidance on the distinction between intentional action and action which are the result of confusion or heedlessness, and in terms of the karmic consequences of speech and whether they're comparable?
Heedlessness and confusion. And whether that's bad karma, you mean? Yes, it would be. So, I mean, confusion would basically be like moha. Yeah, moha, you have three kind of roots of actions. Lobha-dosa moha. And those who don't know, lobha is when greed or desire, dosa is anger or will, and the moha is delusion or confusion. So it is. So that's why you have to be careful. If you feel very confused about something, don't make a decision when you're confused about things. The art of decision making is actually very interesting, because we have to make so many decisions in life, and we have to make sure we do it in a wise way. And one of the principal ways in which we should have to make sound decisions in life, make sure you are in a good set of mind. Yeah, you are at peace, you are relaxed, you have a sense of clarity about yourself. So that is when you should make a decision, not when you feel confused or angry. Never make a decision when you're angry, because you're bound to make mistakes when you do that. So for that reason, if you are confused, be very careful. It's very likely that you make a mistake. It's precisely because of the confusion. Of course, if you are aware that you are confused, it's going to be helped a little bit, because you're going to kind of restrain yourself a little bit. You ideally wait for that kind of state. But the main point is that when you, an act is only bad, it isn't motivated by that confusion. Yeah? So the driving force for that volitional or that intentional activity has to be the confusion itself. So if you are really confused of what's going on, think, oh yeah, I'm confused, okay, I'm just going to do this or whatever. So you are driven by that, that is where the problem arises. The same thing with the heedlessness. If you are heedless, in other words, not careful about how you're supposed to live and all these kind of things. If that heedlessness, what drives our activity, that is where it gets problematic. But if you understand, okay, I'm heedless now, I've got to be really careful, then if it's something else that is motivating your action, then it's not such a big problem. You see, so it is actually the motivation that is a significant factor here. What is driving your activity? And motivation, it's not just about being confused. No matter whether that confusion is the thing that drives your actions. Yes,
is confusion actually like the opposite of consciousness, or is consciousness the way that you work with consciousness in terms of moving it towards a more positive state? So
yeah.
I think because you started out with talking about delusion, it's still a delusion at the beginning of the process.
Yeah.
Is that the absence of consciousness, or is it just the way that you work with consciousness which can work towards?
It's more like the way you work with consciousness. It's the illusion aspect of consciousness. Yeah. Consciousness is just awareness itself, and the illusion is one of the factors that kind of affects your consciousness or affects your mind. If you can imagine that life is really like experience. Yeah, that's what life consists of, a large number of experiences connected together. And part of that experience is like, you see things like that. This is kind of forms. Yeah, you see things. You feel things. You perceive things. You perceive, chandeliers or whatever. Kind of chandeliers, pretty cool. And so you have whatever it is. Yeah? And so you perceive things. And you have intentions or volitions that drive you. And then you have consciousness, which is the ability to be aware of things. But your consciousness what your consciousness feels like, whether it is conjoined with good feelings or bad feelings, that will depend on all your intentional activities. And sometimes consciousness is conjoined with illusion. Yeah, you can delude it. So your awareness is deluded in a sense. So our job is to purify that awareness as much as possible, to remove the constraints on the awareness. Because as long as it is constrained, you can't really act properly. You don't know what is it, what you want benefit, what other people benefit. So we take away those defilements, we take away those constraints, and it enables you to actually be better as a consequence. So these are all interrelated, but they're not actually, they're slightly different angles on you know, on this problem.
To get rid of delusion, as you were saying, that you need to see the image with the so, let's use type of meditation. Like, say, one of the types of meditation, say, the object is the breath. And there are other types of meditation, the pattern, as they talk about the pattern, like body meditation, and going around and seeing the ending of anicca or sensation. So, which one, so if you can meditate, so do you just choose the breath? And is the breath that the teacher? The reality of Arjuna Gaha, and then you go to Samadhi, and then do you go to the Anapana, the 16th step, you go through that, those stages, or do you not say, oh, well, let's do this Vipassana meditation? And if that's the case, what exactly do you do in a Vipassana meditation?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the very interesting things that people always ask about, if someone knows this Vipassana meditation. One is, the most interesting thing about this is that if you read the sutta, the Buddha never talks about Vipassana meditation or Samatha meditation, he just talks about meditation, yeah? So this is a very modern kind of terminology that really arose in Burma in the late 19th century. A very famous scholar, they decided that basically started this kind of whole Vipassana meditation movement. And he influenced Mahasi Sayadaw, he influenced the Goenka tradition. All the main Vipassanists are influenced by Ledi Sayadaw. And it's a historical development that came out of Burma. Yeah, so it's a very specific thing, it's a historical context. It is not really how the Buddha taught meditation. I'm not saying it is wrong, yeah, I'm just saying that this is a particular interpretation of the sutta that arose in Burma at a particular time. But if you don't look at how the Buddha explains things, he just talks about meditation as such. And the way that he used the words vipassana and samatha, he used them not as meditation objects or meditation techniques, but as qualities of the mind. Yeah? So samatha means the calm aspect of the mind. Vipassana means the clear seeing aspect of the mind. I prefer clear seeing to insight. I think it's a more appropriate translation. So two aspects of the mind. And when you meditate in the right way, regardless of what object you use, whether you use the feeling in the body, you use the breath, you use a, you know, you use a death contemplation or whatever it is, if you do meditation right in the right way, you get both samatha and vipassana at the same time. These things are always conjoined. Why are they conjoined? And the reason is because they have the same cause. What is the cause? The cause is the reduction of defilements. And the way to understand this is that if you have, you know, if you have defilements in your mind, yeah, if you have desire or ill will or whatever, desire always kind of agitates the mind. Makes you think about things. How can I get this? You always go into the future, yeah? Desire is always about the future. Ill will is often about the past. They said this to me, how can I say this to me? Yeah, it's terrible, right? You know, yeah, even Buddhists, people say this thing. Wow, that's really terrible. You think like that, yeah? This monk said this, this monk is supposed to be nicer, yeah? How can I say this thing? Etc., etc. So, it always takes you out of the present moment. It doesn't make you peaceful then. So, defilements take you away from peace. When you have defilements of the mind, when you have desire, you have a vested interest in the object of your desire. Yeah, if you have someone you are very kind of attached to, or you're in love with, or you have a child or whatever, if a child misbehaves in public, have you got any children? Yes, children. No, you have a children, okay. If your child misbehaves in public, no, don't do that, yeah, come, please, you know. Why? Because, in part, because if it reflects on you, yeah, this is my child, I'm not kind of doing the upbringing properly, yeah. So it becomes like this thing, so you have it. That's the interest in how the people that we are close to us, how they live, yeah? If you get too attached to the monks, yeah, you think, oh, this monk and this nun, they're so wonderful. And one day we misbehave, yeah? You feel so disappointed, yeah? You have the vested interest in your monk. This is my monk or my nun, yeah? This is kind of ours. So they're going to behave in the right way. Yeah? So when you have desires, when you have your will, you have vested interest, you can't see things clearly according to reality. You see things in accordance with that attachment. This particular person. So, because of that, we don't have clear seeing. So this is the problem, is that the root cause of both lack of clear seeing and lack of calm is the same.
So by eliminating the departments of the mind, we get both calm and clear seeing, both samatha and vipassana. So the job of a meditator is to reduce the defilements. So whatever meditation you use that reduces your defilements in the monorama will produce both samatha and vipassana. You get both insight for both clear seeing and calm as a consequence. And one of the wonderful things that the Buddha said in the sutta is that if you practice just watching the breath, yeah, so easy to watch the breath, it can't get much easier than that actually. You know, you say please, but actually you still can't do it. It's very, very easy, supposedly. You just watch the breath. And according to the Buddha, you can watch the breath, and if that's all you do, and it can take you all the way to awakening, according to the Anapanasati Sutta. By watching the breath, you fulfill the four applications of mindfulness, the four Satipatthanas. You fulfill simply by watching the breath. You fulfill the seven factors of awakening, and you eventually fulfill awakening itself. All you have to do is watch the humble breath. Yeah, it's like kind of nice. Sit back here. And when the breath is delightful, when you're feeling calm and relaxed, and you get joy coming with it, it's such a beautiful thing. And it's so simple. And it takes you all the way to awakening. One of the suttas I'll be doing on the Paramahansa retreat after this, I'm going to do the Anapanasati Sutta. Yeah? So are you coming to the retreat? Yes? Okay, good. So you'll be there and you will know all about how to apply the Anapanasati in such a way. Okay,
you know, modern mindfulness teaching, they talk about non-judgmental awareness.
Yeah.
The Buddha taught like this.
In a sense, it is, because one of the things that I didn't say, but I would have just had more time before, is that in this sequence of dependent liberation, one of the things that will attend there is that this is not to be done by will. Na chetanaya karaniya. Yeah? Chetanaya, chetana is the will, not to be done through will. Well, actually, it's more like this cannot be done through using the will. So what that means is that when you watch the breath, when you kind of do your meditation of it, whatever it is, if you're not going to use the will, well, there's only one other way, and that is to allow it to happen naturally. Yeah? And that is what non-judgmental awareness really is. You don't actually try to control anything. You try just to be aware of things that they are. So in one way, there is an idea of non-judgmental awareness. On the other hand, it is also the case that in Buddhism, as your mind becomes more peaceful, you actually direct it towards certain objects. Yeah? So we try to use the breath as an object of the awareness. So in that sense, it is a little bit judgmental in the sense that you eliminate everything else to just be able to follow the breath. So there is some truth to that, but there's also some limitation to that idea. Yeah, but when you kind of bring it together like that, then I think you are on the right track. So. Okay, good. Excellent. Yeah, nice to meet you all. So, that's it. So, then I won't want to do that. Anyhow, you want to take the microphone?
No?
Does not want to take the microphone. Okay. Should we just bow to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha to finish off? Is that a nice thing to do? Let's just do that as a nice finishing off. Don't have to do it if you don't want to. Just go off and do it once you want.